Welcome to Life in Debt, your practical debt education program. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, an award-winning, listener-supported, open-source grassroots community radio station broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield. Please note that these presentations are provided as a public service for general information purposes only and are not intended to be legal opinions, legal advice, or complete discussions of any legal issues. Remember, every individual's factual situation is different, and you should seek independent legal advice from an attorney familiar with the laws of your state or locality regarding specific information. The name of this show is Life and Debt, and it is a weekly half-hour educational show looking at all types of issues related to debt as it influences your life. This show provides practical, general knowledge about what to look for regarding debt, what are traps and pitfalls, and what to do to be an educated debtor. It's useful to get some notebook paper and pen to take notes during the show. So we've been going through Confessions of an Economic Hitman by John Perkins, a New York Times number one bestseller from 2004. And I will continue where I left off in the last show.
And this will be the last episode of the book. And it really is the epilogue to the original book, written primarily because a good amount of time has passed since John finished writing. The book itself was an immediate and unexpected grassroots success that made it to every major bookseller list and had been published in 17 languages. During a year and a half right after he wrote the book, John traveled around the United States and South America. He talked with people from all walks of life and political persuasions and received hundreds of emails and letters. The most common response to the book he paraphrased as follows, quote, "I knew in my heart that the empire building you described was happening, but everyone told me I was paranoid. Your book has confirmed what I knew. Now I will take action," end quote. A number of people have also told John that their initial reaction was anger at him. Quote, "You lived a great life as an EHM. Now you've come clean and have a bestseller. Do you expect me to forgive you?" End quote. They also told him that when they confronted their deeper feelings, they realized that much of their anger was self-directed. Quote, "I shop at Walmart, buy Nike shoes, and use too much oil. It's easy to blame you, the politicians, and the corporatocracy. Now I realize that I need to do something positive, and I will." Close quote. John continues that our nation's history is rife with examples of citizens coming together to enact change. Reflecting the spirit of this determination is an amazing call to action John recently came across in a book he was reading. Quote, "Never was a cause more important or glorious than that which you are engaged in, not only your wives, your children, and distant posterity, but humanity at large. The world of mankind are interested in it, for if tyranny should prevail in this great country, we may expect liberty will expire throughout the world. Therefore, more human glory and happiness may depend upon your exertions than ever yet depended upon any of the sons of men." Close quote. Signed simply "A Free Man," this message seemed very timely. Yet it first appeared in the New England Chronicle in 1775, at a time when Americans were terribly divided over how to deal with an oppressive empire. John was struck by the similarities between that period of history and the current one. The world's most powerful empire, Great Britain, had overstepped its bounds. Refusing to listen to the legitimate complaints of oppressed peoples, the empire responded to desperate acts of rebellion, like the Boston Massacre, with military brutality. Americans were confused. Many believed they had an obligation to support their king, no matter how violent his actions. Many more thought they did not stand a chance at changing the system, a system they had been taught to believe was the most just in history. Those who opposed the empire were labeled as traitors. They were threatened with the hangman's noose. In reading the diaries of British Revolutionary War soldiers, John discovered that they were impressed by the affluence of America. The land was bountiful, farms prospered, the city seemed like paradise compared to European cities in the 18th century. These soldiers were shocked to see that people who lived such good lives would risk all by defying a government and army that appeared invincible and, in fact, was their own government and army. Calls for support, like the one written by a free man, went a long way to helping Americans understand that they could do better and to inspiring them to take action. The next year, 1776, was a difficult and tumultuous one. American soldiers, lacking clothes, food, shelter, ammunition, leadership, and pay, deserted by the thousands. General Washington and his staff made fatal blunders and lost major battles in and around New York City. A movement to fire him escalated. The revolution was poised to collapse. Thomas Paine had already inspired American patriotism in his pamphlet Common Sense. Once again, he took up his pen. The American crisis appeared on the streets 2 days before Christmas in 1776. Its impact was immediate and profound. Its stirring opening echoes down through the ages to us today. Quote, "These are the times that try men's souls. The summer soldier and the sunshine patriot will, in this crisis, shrink from the service of his country. But he that stands it now deserves the love and thanks of man and woman. Tyranny, like hell, is not easily conquered. Yet we have this consolation with us, that the harder the conflict, the more glorious the triumph." Close quote. Today we have arrived at a similar moment in history. Our own government, in alliance with the big corporations and banks, has created an empire that brings servitude, misery, and death to millions of people. As a result, we who reside within the walls of the empire find ourselves living in constant fear of those who claim the right to defend themselves against what they view as tyranny. We are terrified of suicide bombers, airplane hijackers, and even neighbors hailing from different ethnic backgrounds. We worry about the consequences of sending our young men and women into places like Iraq and Afghanistan, where their lives are in danger and they run the risk of killing innocent civilians. We question the morality of prison camps operated by our military in far-off lands. We suspect that our soldiers are involved in torture, rape, and pillage. We fret about the impacts this war will have on their psyches, as well as on world opinion. Perkins continues and says, "Many of us are guilty of being sunshine patriots. We know that service to our country is not simply a matter of joining the military or blindly supporting foreign interventions and other policies that favor the corporatocracy. We understand that true patriotism demands that we take action in defense of the principles so eloquently expressed in our most revered documents, those forged by our founding fathers. Loyalty requires that we stand, like American men and women during the Revolution, to oppose the tyranny of empire. Service to our country commands us to take actions that will deserve the love and thanks of man and woman for generations to come, actions that will lead to a more equitable and therefore peaceful world. Yet, still, we defer. We bask in the sunshine of the illusory benefits empire has brought to our shores." As John traveled across the United States after the publication of Confessions, he found people who teetered on the edge of what he came to think of as a modern revolution. He heard them express outrage at our leaders. They recognized the truth that the mainstream press, politicians, and corporate executives are determined to ignore, that Iraq and Afghanistan and Iran and Venezuela and all the other members of the evil axis are not the real problem. The events in those and so many other countries are merely symptoms of a system that, like the British Empire in the 1770s, has run amok. People throughout the land understand that the real problem is a corporatocracy that has grown so selfish and greedy and so entrenched that it threatens the security of the United States and indeed the very survival of our species and many other life forms. In forum after forum and emails and letters, John heard questions that were deeply disturbing because of what they had to say about the United States and attitudes towards her. John suspected that many readers of Confessions had similar questions, so he offered a sample of some of the most frequently asked ones and his responses. The first question is, how come you're still alive? Aren't you afraid that a jackal will silence you? His response is, listen closely to this question. Nothing in Confessions is seditious. I am a loyal American whose forefathers fought in most of our major wars, including the Revolution. I wrote Confessions because I believe we are a great nation and that we can do much better than to continue building an empire that is hated by millions. I hoped I would inspire us to improve ourselves and the world our children will inherit. Does that provide grounds for a jackal to come after me? If you believe it does, then you have a responsibility to do something. You must take action. When I have received a few angry letters, I try not to fear reprisal by the jackals. I know that I must focus on creating a better world for my daughter and her brothers and sisters around the planet. The fear that we will not create such a world far outweighs my occasional temptation to fear reprisals. I also hope that the jackals are smart enough to know that the book is already out and that killing me would sell millions more copies. The next question, have other EHMs stepped forward? Yes, several EHMs and jackals have contacted me since the publication of Confessions. They've shared their own extraordinary stories about recent events in the Middle East, Latin America, and Africa. Many of them are still connected to the EHM or jackal business, either actively employed or tied in through pensions and retirement funds, or as consultants, and are reluctant to be named. At least one appears ready to write his own book under his own name. The next question, what reaction, if any, have you received from your former associates at Maine? I've heard from quite a few. Most of these were either employees of mine or other people who were not aware of the EHM aspect of our business. They have confided that reading my story has helped them better understand things that went on at Maine that seemed odd and inexplicable to them at the time. Some of those who were named in the book and others who were in positions to know have been hounded by journalists and, as I would expect, have refused to comment. The exception is Einar Greve, the man who recruited me. After leaving Maine, Einar became president of Tucson Electric Power Company and since has retired. He recently granted an interview to the Tucson Citizen. The interview states, quote, basically his story is true, Greve said. What John's book says is that there was a conspiracy to put all these countries on the hook, and that happened. Many of these countries are still over the barrel and have never been able to repay the loans. Close quote. This is similar to what Einar had communicated to me in a letter. He also disclosed that he was considering writing his own book on this subject. Then the next question John responds to are, how about other people in high places? Are any of them speaking out about EHMs? Yes, many insiders have written about the things I exposed in Confessions. In fact, every major event discussed in my book is confirmed by other sources, from Torrijos' assassination to J-Corp's Saudi Arabian money laundering affair. The major difference is that while most of the other authors were executives at the top of their establishments who wrote academic analyses on these subjects, I was a soldier in the trenches. Mine is a personal, first-person account. Here are several examples of confessions published since 9/11 by people who sat at the top of the pyramid. Joseph Stiglitz, former chief economist of the World Bank and winner of the Nobel Prize in Economics, stated as follows, quote, "Globalization, as it has been advocated, often seems to replace the old dictatorships of national elites with new dictatorships of international finance. To make the IMF's programs seem to work, to make the numbers add up, economic forecasts have to be adjusted. GDP forecasts are not based on sophisticated statistical model or even on the best estimates of those who know the economy well, but are merely the numbers that have been negotiated as part of an IMF program." Close quote. James Henry, former economist for McKinsey and Co. and VP of IBM Lotus, said, quote, "The 1970s have been the heyday of the big project paradigm for economic development. Officials from institutions like the World Bank, the Inter-American Development Bank, the Asian Development Bank, and the U.S. Agency for International Development roamed the globe, making huge project loans and preaching the virtues of sophisticated development planning techniques. By 1990, the developing countries had accumulated more than $1.3 trillion in foreign debt. In 2000, 86% of the U.S. Exim Bank's $7.7 billion in new foreign export credits and guarantees went to just 10 politically influential U.S. companies, including Enron, Halliburton, GE, Boeing, Bechtel, United Technologies, Schlumberger, and Raytheon." Close quote. And I will return to this after station identification. This is Iowa bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you are listening to Life and Debt, your debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. And the final example John gives is Jeffrey Sachs, the director of the Earth Institute at Columbia University and special advisor to the United Nations Secretary General Kofi Annan. Quote, "More than 8 million people around the world die each year because they are too poor to stay alive. The $450 billion the United States will spend this year on the military will never buy peace if it continues to spend around 1/30 of that, just $15 billion, to address the plight of the world's poorest of the poor, whose societies are destabilized by extreme poverty and thereby become havens of unrest, violence, and even global terrorism." Close quote. The next question John was asked is, why did you not discuss the Clinton administration in confessions? He said, "During the 1990s, I was running a nonprofit organization, taking groups into the Amazon and being paid as a consultant who did very little except to keep quiet. For me, it was a very different time from the 1980s when, as CEO of an energy company, I was very aware of what was going on with the first Bush administration and George W.'s oil interests. Clinton and I had nothing to do with each other. I did watch with great interest the way the corporatocracy went after him and Hillary during the first term. It seemed like warning shots fired across the bow, and in fact, those warning shots brought many of Clinton's promised programs to a halt. Later, I had to wonder what he had done to convince them to bring Monica out into the public. After all, they have plenty of negatives to expose on all leaders, but only do so when the need arises." His next question was, "Is the current move to forgive third world debt an indication that EHMs are losing?" His response is, "On the contrary, I'm sorry to say that it shows a new level of sophistication on the part of the EHMs. I certainly favor the idea of forgiving those debts, which, we must remember, were accumulated without the consent of the majority of the people in those countries, and served to make the corporatocracy and a few wealthy third world families even richer. But debt forgiveness is not what this is all about. The G8, which is the United States, the United Kingdom, Canada, France, Germany, Italy, Japan, and Russia, plus the World Bank and the IMF, are once again exploiting these nations, and they are calling it debt forgiveness. They are insisting on conditionalities that are cloaked in phrases like good governance, sound economics, and trade liberalization. While the language is enticing, it is also terribly deceptive. These policies are good and sound only if you are looking at them through corporate windows. The countries that agree to such conditionalities are called upon to privatize their health, education, electric, water, and other public services, in other words, sell them to the corporatocracy. They are forced to drop subsidies and trade restrictions that support local businesses, while at the same time accepting that the U.S. and other G8 countries can continue to subsidize certain G8 businesses and erect trade barriers on imports that threaten G8 industries. When Bolivia gave in to such good governance policies, it opened the door for multinationals to privatize its water supply system. Prices of water skyrocketed, and Bolivians claimed that service was suspended to thousands of people. In Côte d'Ivoire, the French firm that bought the assets of the privatized telephone company reportedly raised prices so high that many people had to forego connections to the system, including university students who could not afford internet access essential for their studies. In Tanzania, these policies led to the appalling situation where children have to pay to go to school and many are simply too poor to do so. Similar stories abound in the countries that have accepted the conditionalities that come as a prerequisite to what is being touted as debt forgiveness. One of the shocking things about this new sham is that so many people seem willing to accept it rather than seeing it for what it truly is, an environmental hitman ploy and the latest and perhaps most subtle step along the road to world empire. The third world, however, is conscious of what is going on, and they are angry. The resistance to the July 2005 G8 meetings in Scotland was, to a large degree, an expression of anger against the deceptions. Many people believed that Blair and Bush were simply playing the good guy, bad guy in an attempt to legitimize a highly exploitive system that is balanced heavily in favor of multinational corporations at the expense of the poor, downtrodden, and starving around the world. When will we in the U.S., which is the coach and captain of the G8 corporatocracy team, demand that our leaders fess up to their lies? When will we admit to the deeper truth behind 9/11, the Madrid and London bombings, and so many other acts of violence, that they may be the acts of fanatical murderers, but that they continue to happen only because millions of people are desperate and are silently applauding? When will someone point the finger and say, look, the emperor isn't wearing any clothes? The next question John presents is, can you please comment on Paul Wolfowitz's appointment as president of the World Bank? John said, Wolfowitz's appointment left no doubt, if any ever existed, that it is not a World Bank. It is a U.S. bank. The president of the United States chooses its president and controls its major decisions. It really doesn't matter what I think of Wolfowitz as a person or manager. The important question should be, what do the Brazilians, Nigerians, Indonesians, and others around the world think of him? If it were a World Bank, selection of its president, along with other major decisions, would be the responsibility of a board comprised of representatives from all continents. The next question is, what advice can you give me? What can I do to change the situation? John responds, I offer a number of suggestions in the last chapters of Confessions. To do more than that, to tell you specifically what you should do, would be to follow in the corporatocracy's footsteps and say, here, this is my product, buy my silver bullet. That isn't an answer that will work. In fact, there is no single answer. We each have our own interests, abilities, and skills. I'm a writer. As such, there's a great deal I can do. But it is different from what a teacher, corporate lawyer, massage therapist, or car mechanic has to offer. You must ask yourself, what am I interested in doing? Where are my strengths and weaknesses? What speaks to my heart? One of the great strengths of the American Revolution was that it utilized the individual skills of many diverse people. Tom Paine wrote, but did not try to lead armies. George Washington led armies and did not write pamphlets. Benjamin Franklin, in his 70s, was an incredibly successful envoy to our French-speaking potential allies. Frontier hunters became sharpshooters. Fishermen sailed ships that harassed the British fleet. Women sent clothes and food to the battlefront. Children molded a shot for soldiers' guns. If you are a teacher, challenge your students to read between the lines of history and of the statements made in today's newspapers. If you are a corporate lawyer, guide your clients into becoming more environmentally and socially responsible. If you are a massage therapist or a car mechanic, ask your clients how they feel about a current event in the news. Starting a dialogue is one of the easiest and most effective ways to spread the ideas of change. One thing we each can and must do is to educate ourselves and those around us. Democracy is based on an educated populace, not just one that is able to read and write, but also a people who constantly ask important questions. We must be skeptical of our leaders, corporate executives, and our press. We must insist that they provide us with information. We all need to read between the lines. These questions and the exchanges that often follow during John's public engagements or on call-in radio shows convinced him that millions of people in the United States are deeply concerned about what we are doing and how our lifestyles impact the world. They are concerned and, like hundreds of millions around the planet, they are angry. Since the original publication of Confessions, the role of corporatocracy, along with the greed and its willingness to kill its own people, as well as those it calls enemy, has become more apparent to more people on every continent, including North America. With this challenging consciousness comes a greater responsibility for us all to speak out and to take whatever actions are appropriate for each of us as an individual and as a member of the world community. These are the times that try men's souls. We will be faced with increasing acts of desperation by those who feel cheated and oppressed by the corporatocracy. Whether terrorism occurs in Manhattan, Madrid, London, Riyadh, or La Paz, it is essential that we understand that in the long term, these horrible acts will not be stopped by the military or by security guards in airports and along our borders. They will only be stopped when enough of us demand that our corporations, banks, and governments cease to exploit the majority of the world's population and resources, and when we insist on dealing with the world from a place of compassion, the very place envisioned by our founding fathers when they wrote, quote, "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or to abolish it, and to institute new government, laying its foundation on such principles and organizing its powers in such form as to them shall seem most likely to affect their safety and happiness." And that's Confessions of an Economic Hitman coming to an end, and we will continue in the next show. This is Iowa bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you have been listening to Life and Debt, your debt education program. If you have any questions or comments, call the station at 641 641- 209-1083, or you can email me at lifeanddebt@gmail.com. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. May you enjoy and have a healthy and prosperous debt manageable life.